are pouring bombardment from sea into Magician Bay, into the land areas. They were just laying a heavy blanket of bombardment in there, and they had all these shore batteries covered up. And furthermore, we decided later on, the Japs decided not to divulge their position of their shore batteries by firing back at them or at us. And so they didn't open up at all. But we found out later that they were just ready to blow us out of the water. And only for that fact that they didn't want to take the chance of giving their position, they didn't open up. In the meantime, our cruisers were lobbing those 6 and 8 inch shells over the top of us, and we could hear them whistling, and we didn't worry too much about that because we knew their gunnery was pretty accurate. There was no chance of their lowering their sights and hitting us by mistake. Well, they did not allow us, the commanding naval officers of that operation did not allow us to conduct a clearing sweep because evidently they had decided that it would be too dangerous and there would be no point anyway because we weren't going to make a landing, our landing forces weren't going to make a landing there anyway. It was just a feint or a decoy operation that had us sweeping over there and trying to give the Japs the opinion that we were going to land there. Our next job was to proceed through Tinian Channel, which was a narrow channel between the islands, the south end of Saipan and the north end of Tinian, and we were to go back over and report to the offshore screening officer, who was a destroyer division commander, and we were given an assignment of and a submarine patrol off the west coast, and that was what we did for the rest of the day. Well, as nightfall came, standard procedure called for all landing ships, LSTs, and any large ships, APAs, the troop ships and so on, to retire, meaning get away from the shore, because the Japs by then had sent out the alarm, and if there was going to be any retaliation either from their ships or their aircraft, our landing craft would be sitting ducks. So our landing ships formed up, and we formed up with them as an anti-submarine screen, and we proceeded out to sea up to the northwest of Saipan. Well, we expected to come back in first light and continue the operation. Well, we didn't come in, and this raised a big question in our mind. Well, we began to get some inkling of this through some red-hot radio traffic that was flying around there. We knew something big was happening. Well, it later turned out that the Battle of the Philippine Sea was taking place just to the south of us, probably 50 or 60 miles. And this was the famous battle that was known as the Marianas Turkey Shoot, in which our carrier, fast carrier forces won one of the major battles of the war and in effect finished off the naval air threat that the Japanese had. From that point on, they never had enough aircraft. They lost 300 and some aircraft in that battle. They never had enough aircraft or seasoned pilots to launch any kind of a serious threat against us. But from then on, a couple of days later, after while we were out there steaming around, we had some submarine scares, and some of the destroyers conducted submarine anti-submarine attacks, dropped depth charges and so on. We stayed pretty much in our position in the screen that we'd been assigned, because we did not make any any submarine contacts. About 2 days later, we were assigned to a convoy that was to take wounded back. By then, there were substantial wounded resulting from landings there at Sharon Kanoa, and they wanted to get him back to Pearl Harbor as quickly as possible and get him in the hospitals to save as many as they could. So we were lined up with a couple of other destroyers, and we screened the transports, the APAs, back to Pearl. Well, from then on, we were on more or less routine. We came back near the end of the landings on Guam. That was a successful, a very tough landing. And from then on, for the next several months, we were in that area running to and from Ulithi, which is one of our bigger bases out in the forward area. Also to Eniwetok and other Central Pacific areas. Really got to be quite routine and quite boring. One of the more interesting duties that we had is we were coming up into late 1944 was escorting our submarines to and from the operating areas. Now, we didn't go way out into the hot operating areas, but there was an arrangement when they came in from a submarine patrol off the Japanese coast. They had to come to a certain point, which would be maybe 60 or 70 miles northwest of Guam. And by then, we were calling Guam our home base. And we would escort them in so that our own patrol aircraft wouldn't mistake them for Japanese submarines and sink them. So we would escort them in and out so that our people would realize that they were our own. Well, coming up to, we had a few air raid scares around when we were around Guam and around Saipan, mostly at night, but we had very efficient CAP, Combat Air Patrol, and they managed to fend them off and keep them away. By middle January, we had gotten our operating orders for the landings on Iwo Jima. And I had those in my locked in my safe in my stateroom and fully expected to be a part of that operation. However, I got lucky and orders came through to me to head back to the States. So I turned command over to my second in command, who was the executive officer, and I couldn't get out of there fast enough. I hated to leave the boys. I had a lot of good friends and subordinates that I had grown fond of, but I wanted back to the States to my family just as quick as I could. So I boarded a DC-4 at Guam, and we made one stop on a small island on the way to Pearl, stayed one day in Pearl, and then we were on our way back to San Francisco. So Emily was there to meet me, arrived at nighttime, but she managed to get down there and find the airfield, and we had a wonderful reunion, a family reunion. My orders had called for me then to proceed to San Pedro for training at the SCTC base. It looked then like I might be getting ready for a command of a destroyer escort. That's what I had been hoping for. It was a larger ship than the AMs, but not as interesting a ship. We had more capabilities on these 220-foot AMs than the DE. All the DE had was they had 2 3-inch guns and the usual hedgehog up front and depth charges. We had all of that, plus our minesweeping capability, plus we had the capability of towing. And it turned out later that our class of ships out in Okinawa, and the fleet got beat up so bad, our ships were very important in that they were able to tow large ships like cruisers that were damaged, to tow them out of the forward area. Anyway, before we had a little leave time, but we were getting ready to head back to the east, down to San Pedro, change orders came through calling for me to report to Little Creek, Virginia, to the Mine Warfare Center there. That meant I was going to be staying in mine craft, which was all right with me, but I would have liked to have had one of the new destroyer escorts, if possible. Anyway, we loaded up all our gear, and most of it we loaded in barrels, and the Navy shipped it for us over to West Palm Beach. And we started out, and we drove across country, a very interesting trip, down through the New Mexico and Arizona, through the desert. And Joanna was at that age, when she was about 15 months, and she was eating baby food, which came in little cans. Well, Emily would like to give it to her hot, because that was intended that way. We devised a little system that whenever we were planning to stop to eat, we'd usually have picnics along the way, we would stop the car and put her baby food on the manifold, and that we'd drive a little further, and that would heat the baby food up. And when we decided to stop, there was Joe with a hot meal, hot cans of baby food. We came on and stopped momentarily in New Orleans, and then proceeded on to Florida, where we had a little leave time, could be with the family. And then had to proceed up to Little Creek. Well, I got into Little Creek, and was given orders to be under instruction, meaning that I would be in classes much like I had been when I was at Yorktown back in 1941. I had been in class for about a week when one day a yeoman came in and handed me an envelope. I said, "What's this?" He said, "Look at it." I opened it up, and it was orders to take command of the USS Pilot, which was a sister ship of the Herald, which I had had command of up to that point all through the Pacific. Well, I said to myself, "This is great," because I knew what the pilot was doing. It was the school ship, and it had just wonderful duty. You were out during the day running up and down the Chesapeake taking students out, and we would teach them how to stream gear and all the details of the ship and so on. And at night time I would be home, so I could be with my family. I said, "Well, I'm going to have this for a year." That was standard procedure. When you came back from the Pacific or forward area, you'd have you'd have at least a year stateside. But that was not to be. It seems that the pilot, the ship, and its crew had been in the Mediterranean, and they had been back in the States for a year, and they were ripe to head on out. And they needed an experienced skipper, so they grabbed me. Well, I called Washington, and I was pretty hot about it. I said, "Well, we're sorry, but we're short of experienced skippers now, and we just have to put you in command of it, because that ship is needed badly. We're getting ready for a big operation out there." Well, I knew about that. It was Operation Olympic, which was scheduled to be a landing on the south shores of Kyushu. Well, we had a little time to prepare ourselves for this, because I had had about 3 weeks of that good duty, which was to end prematurely, running out every day. But we did have some extra time in which they had sent the ship to Portsmouth Navy Yard, which is near Norfolk, for some new armament changes and to get it ready for sea, because it hadn't had any overhaul or anything. So we were in Portsmouth Navy Yard for about another month, but then it was time to leave, and that was one of the most difficult times of my life, when I had to say goodbye to Emily and Joanna. They were down at the dock. And I can only describe this as a stiff upper lip kind of a situation, where we had no alternative, and we never really, again, never knew whether we would ever see each other again. Well, the ship left, we went down to Guantanamo and did had a few days of shakedown there and testing our guns and new armament and so on. Proceeded on down through the canal. As we were exiting the canal on the Pacific side, we received a dispatch by radio telling us to proceed up to Long Beach for further work on the ship. We didn't know what that was all about. We'd just come out of a repair yard. We got up there and found that in the short time since we had had that work done at Portsmouth, they had made further modifications, which we had to get there. Well, they sent us into a private yard at Newport Beach, California, which is near San Pedro, and we were there another 3 weeks. Well, I said to myself, I'm going to see if we can't have one more last get-together, Emily and I. So I had heard about a system called basket leave. Normally, you'd have to go through the senior officer present, which was, in this case, was a battleship commander at San Pedro, and get permission from him to get a leave. Well, I didn't want to take that chance because he'd probably turn me down. Well, basket leave is a device that you use where you have one of your own officers write up the orders, or the yeoman write up the orders giving you leave, and you take off. Well, if something happens, you're needed at the ship, they get in touch with you and say, get back here right away. If nothing happens, the leaves just sit in a basket without getting the appropriate officer, in other words, the SOPA's signature on authorizing it. Well, Emily and I agreed to meet at New Orleans, which was a little closer to the East Coast than West Coast, but I rode a commercial airline over there and had no trouble getting in. She came the other direction, and we had a few wonderful days together there in New Orleans. Well, it came time to go back. Well, going back, I had planned to go back on MATS, Military Air Transport. Well, I didn't have a very high, being on leave, I didn't have a very high priority. And there was a lot of priority traffic, personnel heading for the West Coast, getting ready for this big operation. So I got bumped. I decided, well, I'll take a commercial airline from New Orleans then to Dallas, and I bumped some civilians off that. That was a dirty trick, but I had to move. I had to get back. Well, I got over there, and I waited around and waited and waited, and I couldn't find anybody I could that had a lower priority than I did. And finally, after about 24 hours of just sitting in the terminal, in the military air transport terminal, I got a break and I got on and got back. So I was back with nobody knowing the difference, and we were just now getting ready to wind up and get ready to head on out. Well, right at this time was the time when the atomic bombs were dropped. And this was a big surprise to us. We didn't know. It was a very hush-hush thing. Well, the first bomb dropped. Everybody began to speculate that this might end the war. A second bomb was dropped, and sure enough, Within a few days, the Japs sued for peace, and we knew that good news was going to be ours. Well, we had to get on out there anyway. Our orders were to get on out to the forward area because we didn't know just what the situation was going to be. So we got underway for Pearl, stopped over one day there, headed on out for Saipan, stopped over 2 days, and we're ready to move on to Okinawa. Well, we got the orders together, and they called me and said, we've got several ships that, there are 13 ships all together, most of them smaller than yours, YMSs and a few larger ships, but slower ships, and you're the senior officer, so you're going to be the commander of the task unit of these groups. I said, boy, that's kind of heavy. Well, anyway, we got underway, and I was in tactical command and gave all the orders. It was nothing too tough to do because we were just going to be doing straight sailing. But after we'd been out about a day and a half, we got news over the weather radio that there was a typhoon coming up from the south. Well, what to do? If we continued on, we would be right in the path of the typhoon, and we would be in big trouble because those smaller ships were not big enough to stand any heavy seas. In fact, they had lost two or three YMSs that had sunk in a typhoon on a similar type crossing like this just a short time before over near Okinawa. So we got our heads together and decided that we would maneuver the task force to the south and keeping track of its movement, the typhoon's movement, we would try to duck around it and get behind it and let it pass us by. Well, we did just that, and we did it very nicely with no big problems. The only thing we got out of it were some huge swells. I've never seen any of this size before or since. These swells were so huge that had been propagated by the typhoon that our 13 ships were lined up in three columns, a distance of about 500 yards between the columns. And we would be in what would amount to the trough as we were going across. Normally, if you're in the trough of waves, you're rocking a lot, rolling. But these waves were so huge, and they didn't break. They were just huge, great, huge waves that the each of the three columns would rise right up as the waves, the crest of the waves would pass under, and you would ride over the top of them, hardly even be aware of the movement of the waves. And you would look to the column on the side of you, we were the middle column, being the OTC, and we'd look to the right, and here would be the column on the right of us, would be down the trough, and we'd be looking like we were looking down from a mountain. Down in the trough, then we'd be down in the trough, and we'd look over on the other side, and the other ones would be look like they were up on top of a mountain. Well, it was really a fantastic appearance. Well, we had that same experience again. One of the men on one of the other ships had appendicitis. What to do? Well, we decided we had our division doctor aboard us, but he was not an experienced surgeon, and he didn't want to tackle an appendectomy at sea anyway, so we decided to try what they'd done in the other case, and they packed the man on ice, and he was able to last it through till they could get him to a hospital ship at Okinawa. Well, we arrived at Okinawa without difficulty, except we were about 3 days late. And they said, Where were you? We didn't hear from you, and we thought you all got sunk by that typhoon. I said, no, we were in good shape, and we just weren't able to get through to you. Well, we were in Okinawa for the first time. About a week, waiting further orders, and another typhoon came up. And this turned out to be the major typhoon of the season, maybe for 7 years, and it was a bad one. And it hit right dead on Buckner Bay, where we were anchored. But we were given orders, along with other larger ships that were able to get underway and that were able to make it out to sea. And we were told to steam independently, to stay clear of other ships, and use your own discretion to stay out of the way of the typhoon. But we got out there, and it was a bad one, all right. But we stayed about 65 miles away from the center, and we steamed just with enough way on to keep steerage way, and at very slow speed. We were probably about 5 to 7 knots. And we came through that in pretty good shape, but the mayhem that occurred at Buckner Bay was unbelievable. When we came back, we were given some kind of an idea of what had happened. Buckner Bay, which is roughly a crescent shape, was ringed around with sunken ships, mostly small ones, landing craft and so on. And we were told that 1,000 men were missing from that storm. It had been washed overboard or on little vessels that were washed out to sea. But we were told not to come into port, but to get out and start searching for survivors. Well, we were out there for about a week searching, but never found any survivors. It was a terrible catastrophe. Loss of life, loss of ships, small ships, and probably the worst of its kind of the whole war. Well, soon after that, we were given our orders to proceed up to Japan, to Sasebo, and report to the officer in charge of minesweeping up there. We went up there and had anchored in Sasebo, our first experience of being in Japan, went ashore, and managed to commandeer a jeep, and a few of us took a trip back up into the hinterland and looked at the local culture, and we were a little dubious about how the Japanese would look at us, but it turned out they were in awe of us, and they were in fact very defensive. They weren't going to do anything to disturb us, you can be sure of that. Well, we wanted to buy souvenirs, so we found some China shops back in our town, back up from Sasebo, and we bought up a whole bunch of that, and the problem then was getting it back to the States eventually, and I did get mine back when I finally got to go back to the States without any damage at all. That was quite surprising. Well, we then reported to the officer and tactical man to command of the largest minesweeping operation of the war, which was a field of some 60,000 O-type mines, moored mines, that were out in the East China Sea. Before that, we had one assignment, which was to escort a small naval vessel to the China coast. Well, the China coast is about 100 miles away across the China Sea at this point. Well, this was kind of tricky because we were just as green about those waters as the ship that we were escorting. But I guess because we were a little larger and supposedly had more experience navigating people, why they gave us the job. But we escorted it over. They were headed for Shanghai, and we crossed over into the Yellow Sea, and it was yellow. Yellow because it's muddy. It's very shallow. And our fathometer told us that we had, most of the time, had less than 4 or 5 fathoms of water, which is very shallow. But there were no rocks or pinnacles or anything like that, hazards to worry about. Anyway, we dropped our charge off about 35 miles off the China coast and headed back. Then we proceeded on down, according to orders, and joined the minesweeping fleet, which was down south west of Sasebo, and we started our minesweeping duties. Well, it turned out the officer in tactical command was Lee Jackson, who had been the original executive officer on the little 97-foot minesweeper Turaco, which I had been a sister ship of the Tapacola, my first assignment. And later on, he left to go to mine warfare school, and I took over from him as commanding officer of the Turaco. Well, I never saw him again until that day when I reported to him as OTC. Well, we had a good chat and reminisced and so on. He was a commander, full commander by that time, and I had received my promotion to lieutenant commander before we left the States. Well, we were out in that minefield, and this was these were the first mines, by the way, that we had swept in the whole war. It just happened there were not that many mines around in the Pacific, but there were plenty of them here, so there was enough to keep us busy for many, many months. Well, this was in early November by then, so I got to spend about 3 weeks sweeping for mines, and we had a few close squeaks where mines that we had cut popped to the surface, and normally we have mine-destroying vessels behind us who are coming along and destroying the mines, but sometimes they didn't get them all, and we had to destroy some of our own mines by rifle fire and machine gun fire. Well, at this point in the war, everybody is wanting to get home, naturally, and that included me. Nobody wanted to get home worse than I did. So we got out on what we call points. If you had been in for a long time, and moreover, if you had been in forward areas, like in the Pacific, out in the Pacific, in the Western Pacific, you amassed a certain number of points. Well, it turned out that I had plenty to get out, and when they, I just knew it would be just a short time before I would be given the break, and I did. By late November, right about Thanksgiving time, I got my orders to come back, and I turned the ship over to Bill Semmes, who was my executive officer, and I got aboard a transport there in Sasebo. There were very few Navy people aboard except those who were running the ship. The rest of them were all Marines who had just been released or were sending them back to the States for reassignment or for release. That was a long, long trip, but it was a great sight to come in the Golden Gate again and get ashore, and stayed over one night, got on a train, and started the trek across the country. Stopped over at Chicago for one day, and the temperature was down to just zero. It was early December then, and home was in sight. Just another day or day and a half, and I was back in Jacksonville, where Emily was to meet me with Joanna, because that was where I was to be mustered out. So another wonderful reunion, because when you think back, when we didn't know when we would ever see each other again, this was the sweetest of all. Well, I had a physical there, and they mustered me out, and Emily had the car, our little trusty little Chevy, and we rode on down to Florida and greeted the family, and I had accumulated about 3.5 months of leave that I hadn't been able to take during the war, because I was always getting orders that says go here, go there, and all the leave I would have would be what we call proceed time, which would be just enough time to get you to your next assignment plus 3 or 4 extra days. So I had all this leave accumulated, and Emily and I agreed that we would just take a good long vacation and use all this up, which we did. We were back in Florida, the war was over, The ocean was there and inviting us, so we just had a good time just relaxing and going to the beach every day. And finally, all good things like that came to an end, and I had to be thinking about getting a job. Well, one of the things that I had learned about while I was at sea, I had a copy of Reader's Digest, and there was an article about a product called Ramie, R-A-M-I-E, and it said that it was being grown on an experimental basis in Florida, but that it had a great future, as Ramie was a fiber-type plant which could be made into a very tough, resistant cloth. And this article said the feeling was that there, it had a great future for durable cloth and would probably be one of the great industries of the future. And I said, that's for me. When I get back to Florida, I'm going to check that out. So when my leave was over, I proceeded to an office for Newport Industries in West Palm Beach, hoping to walk in and, as a returned veteran, be given a glad welcome, and they'd hand me a job on a platter and say, come on in, go to work. Well, I went in expecting to find a busy, active company, prosperous. Well, it was a seedy, run-down office. There was only one person in the office. And I came in, he looked at me and he said, what do you want? Very surly individual. I said, well, I read a lot about Ramie and what you people are doing with it, and I felt that this was the industry and the company that I'd like to be associated with. And I'm a returned veteran, so forth. Are you a bookkeeper? Well, no. I've had a few accounting courses, but I don't call myself a bookkeeper. Well, that's the only opening we got. I'm busy. Goodbye. Well, that shut me off. Just put an end to my dreams of becoming involved in Ramie. So I went home pretty downcast, and we sat around a couple more days trying to figure out what else to do. Well, I had in my mind that construction after the war would hold some promise. And I began to try to think where I would go looking for a job there. Well, Emily had an old friend that she had taught school with. We ran into them. They were living in Fort Lauderdale at the time. We went down, dropped in to see them. Well, her husband, Horace Oliver, was working for the Hart Company of Fort Lauderdale. The Hart Company had just built a new branch in Del Rey called the W.A. Hart & Company of Del Rey. And he was also a veteran. He was working kind of as a foreman or a gopher, just in other words, anything they needed for him to do in this new starting up company in Del Rey. And he said, why don't you go see the Hart people and see if you can get a job with them, because they've got a great future. So I called the Hart office in Fort Lauderdale and asked for an appointment with Mr. Hart. Turned out he had a partner called Wilbur Kretz, so they gave me a date and time. I went down. And in the meantime, knowing my shortcomings in the construction industry, I went to the library and checked out a book on construction methods and read up on that so I wouldn't be completely dumb. I had really no experience or background in construction at all, unless you would call growing up in the hardware business somewhat. Anyway, I went in, met the Hart and Kretz, and they were very cordial to me, but they said, really, we don't have anything specific that we can offer you. We certainly appreciate the fact you're a veteran, and Mr. Hart had a short time in the Army. He'd been in the Army Reserve, but he had an automobile accident, and that finished his military career early on. So anyway, I was going to the door to leave, and I said, well, I struck out again. I was just about to go out the door, and Wilbur Kretz came after me. He said, wait a minute. Come back here just a minute. We want to talk to you. And they said, we've just been talking between us here, and we've been talking about an idea that we've had for some time here, that we would like to hire somebody to help us keep track of materials on the job. We think there's a lot of material waste on the job, and we'd like somebody who is, you know, has enough brains to kind of look into that and be a kind of an expediter or analyst. I said, well, that would suit me fine. So they said, well, give us another 10 days to think about it, and we'll let you know. Well, I called them in 10 days, and they said, we decided to hire you. You can start on April the 1st, and we'll work out the details of your job. Well, the job turned out to be not too specific, and it was going to involve accounting. Well, I hadn't had that much accounting, so the first thing I did after being hired was to enroll at Broward Business College in a cost accounting course. So they gave me a desk in a side office, and my job was more or less on my own, and they told me what they wanted, that they wanted me to do some cost accounting and tell them where they were losing money and how they could improve their operation. Well, I spent about four months doing that, and they didn't call for any reports or anything. Finally, I said, I'm ready to give you my analysis, my report. I'd learned some things that this course at Broward Business College that were helpful. So came the day, and I took my report into them, and very interesting. Yes, that looks very good. But that was the end of it. They didn't put it into practice, and I felt kind of down that they wouldn't be more interested in that. But about this time, Wilbur Kretz decided to go in business on his own. He and Mr. Kretz had both been very successful during the war building air bases for the Air Force. They built the one at Boca Raton, they built another one in Brazil, another one in the Azores, and they'd made quite a bit of money. And they were all ready to go. And there was only one other large contractor, Al Turner, in Fort Lauderdale area, so they had it pretty much themselves. But Wilbur had decided he wanted to split up, and he pulled out. And Hart retained me and a couple of other people. Well, in the meantime, he decided to cut out all of the overhead people, and he sent Les Byron, who was another veteran, and myself out to a job that was just starting, an apartment house over in the beach. And they said, you're going to work as carpenters over here. Well, neither of us had worked as carpenters before, but we went and got the rudimentary tools, and we went to work. We laid subfloor. Anybody could do that. We were listed as second-year apprentices, not full journeyman, and we were paid, I think, $1.25 an hour. Well, that brought me up to about what I was getting on my inside job, which was $55 a week. Well, shortly after, about a month after that, Les got a bid from Kretz to go with him, but I was still set up with Hart. Well, about this time also, it became very necessary for us to have a place to live, and we had been renting But the people said, we have winter people coming, and when October comes, you're going to have to get out. Well, that was bad news. So we, Emily and I, talked over and decided we would try to build our own house, because housing was very scarce around Fort Lauderdale. I drew some plans. We bought a lot up on Northeast 15th Avenue for $1,500, and I drew the plans, took them down, and Hart said, and got them approved by the city, and Hart said he would try to help me as much as he could. He would allow me to use the credit of the company to buy materials at Gate City, and if I needed carpenters or subcontractors, I could hire them through the company. So we started out, and on the day that we were to pour our foundation was the day that Chrissy was born. And I had to be at the hospital, and I had to leave the supervising of pouring the slab to Bob Nelson, who was the inside man at the Hart Company, and he came out and did his best. But when I came back that night, and Chris the next day, I found that we had what was called a bust out. They didn't put enough braces on the side of it, and some of the foundation busted out and made it kind of an uneven effect, but that was not serious. We were able to continue on from there. Well, this was a happy time. We were anticipating having a new home. We had the new baby. We had two lovely little children, Joe and Chrissy. And in the meantime, we had to have a place to live. And George and Helen Parker, my cousins, had a little garage apartment, and they took us in. So we lived in their little garage apartment in back of their house until our house was completed. I did most of the work on the house myself, the carpentry, but I had one wonderful fellow who was one of Hart's